Where there's a will, there's a way, actually. But, you know, there's more than one way to skin a cat. The problem is that everyone would really like a multi-band, very small antenna that doesn't require any elevation. And there's more than enough people out there who are more than willing to sell size dummy loads that almost fit all those criteria. So, I'm waiting for someone to violate the laws of physics. So the closest we've gotten to, about 4 years ago, we were talking about this interesting UAF VHF, and I think they're selling it for HF as well. They were very strange antennas or something. They're kind of the shape of a can that sits on top of a car. And apparently, it offers circular polarization. So when it hits structures, it's less likely to just absorb it early, but it gives you a little bit of a signal here or there. We talked about that one way back long ago.
Yes, okay. That rings a bell. Very good. So, I heard Charlie in it before, but he was filling up some dead air when you were gone. That's it. I don't know if anybody else is out there right now, but we'll see. And like I said before, I don't have all that much for the Space Night report, but enough to keep us going, I guess, when the time comes. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, we'll see how tonight works out. I mean, again, I had a short 10-meter net this morning. When things are really rocking, I usually go from about 11 o'clock to about 1, 1.30. I think I called it a day at around noontime this morning. So, you know, sometimes people are busy elsewhere. Everyone has their own life, so we take what we get. So once again, we're here with the technical net. If anyone has any questions or topics for discussion, feel free, hit that magic button, and identify yourself.
Yeah, WB2BXO here, Roy.
Yes, how are you today?
Okay, sounds like you had too much luck on 10 meters this morning.
No, not at all, unfortunately. It was, there was one guy having a conversation with someone else, but they weren't really ID'd themselves when I had an opportunity to listen in. That was it. Otherwise, it was me and a couple of people in Brooklyn, and my DX station was in New Jersey.
Yeah, that's stupid. The band was open. Because there was a lot of activity in the CW contest. I worked a station in Cyprus, probably a huge station that helps. Let's see what else was on there. I'm not sitting in front of the computer. I think I made a few other a couple of other 10-meter contests. Maybe that was the only 10-meter contest, but on CW, there was a lot of activity because of the contest, but it's possible the band was kind of long, so that may be why you didn't get, as well as the lack of activity, perhaps. Anyway, that is kind of interesting, because there was some propagation today on the band.
Oh, okay, that's interesting to know. I could perceive it, listening to, I was only listening to the voice band and such, trying to figure out what was going on, and there wasn't much of anything going on, unfortunately.
Yeah, I'm wondering, I think it was Paul in there before, wondering if he wants to chime in and if he worked anything on 80 meter or some of you with the yellow end in the contest last night.
Paul, was that you?
I don't know, Frank was asking if I was on CW with the contest. No, I wasn't. No, I did not do that. So, I can't report on anything to do with that. I missed that one. Anyway, back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good.
Yeah. I don't remember something else. I do know. One of the local guys mentioned that he didn't realize how much experience his local noise level from computers and power supplies and such. So a local power company had a scheduled outage. He got on the air with power and a laptop computer, and no means of power to cause interference. And the band, 10 and 15 suddenly came alive where he normally could not hear anything. So the local noise, well, I already knew this. One of the reasons, I don't really try to get on from here. The local noise level makes a huge difference in what you can hear.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And, you know, I mean, that's what you have to expect, unfortunately, in a metropolitan area. There's a lot of random EMF all over the place. I know someone in Queens who tells me on some bands his noise floor is something like an S1. My noise floor is an S5. It's pretty consistent. So there's not much I can do about it. So signals that are past S5, I can make out. And stuff below that, unless I use something like FT8, lots of luck.
Well, S5 I think is kind of tolerable. Because if you're using, a wire antenna or apartment antenna, it's difficult to work anything that you're hearing below S5 anyway. S5 is kind of tolerable. I think I probably had something close to an S9 noise level most of the time at my station in Canarsie. I still worked quite a bit, but there was still a lot of stuff I'd hear. And I remember one field day here a couple of years ago, when I was not hearing anything, and I kept telling them, there's something wrong here, and most of the guys who we field day with were not experienced HF operators, and they're like, no, there's nothing wrong. Anyway, when we switched power supplies and got rid of the switching supply we were using to run the radio, suddenly we were able to hear in workstations. Anyway, let me see who else is on here who has some real questions for you. WB2BX show.
Okay, very good, Frank. Thanks for participating. Yeah, there are the never-ending argument between a linear and a switch power supply. You know, decades ago, switch power supplies got rightfully a bad reputation because the proper amount of filtration was not really done well. So you had a lot of background noise. In the last 10 years, I've only been using switching power supplies. I have one from Elinco that if you adjust the baseline switching frequency of the power supply so that if you hit some interference, you can kind of tune it to away from the frequency that you're interested in. I haven't needed to use it, but your mileage might vary. Old-timers particularly have history of really disliking switching power supplies. They're a heck of a lot more efficient and lighter. If they're well-designed, they operate pretty good.
Yeah, I guess some of those that are meant for amateur radio applications or built-in radios, I would presume, but most of the others, are pretty awful. And I think the hams in parts of Europe and in Asia have it even worse because some of those countries don't enforce unintentional RF emission limits at all. America at least tries, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, regulation differs from country to country. I would assume European Union countries have lots of rules and regulations. Maybe Eastern Europe doesn't. But, again, I haven't had any particular problem. I have this weird spur that occurs at intervals on 10 meters which plants itself straight on the usual working frequency for a 10-meter nest, 28.380. So I offset it some kilohertz, and it's beyond that spur. That spur adds about a third of an S-unit to my baseline noise floor. So I figure getting it back by just moving a kilohertz is sufficient, is reasonable. So, I don't know. Like I said, I've been using switching power supplies for the long time, and they work fine by me. I have a watt meter, the ME500, and it was doing some weird problems with computers. It was locking up computers. The guy who designed it built it, sells it, told me to try a linear power supply instead of a switching power supply. It didn't help at all. Well, what I ended up doing was I isolated it from one computer's USB to another computer's USB, and it worked fine that way. But big chunky thing, a linear wall wart power supply. Even though, you know, it's only about 5 watts or something, the thing weighed about almost 2 pounds. So those things go heavy.
Yeah, well, that's why they're popular. No one would carry around a two-pound power supply with their 10-ounce cell phone.
True. But neither would I. I mean, it was an interesting experiment, and I now my parts drawer have that linear, because I just swapped back to the switching power supplies. And, you know, when I found the solution was to swap USB computers instead of I tried isolating it. I tried using hum suppressors, signal cleaners, going through USB connections. They're all worthless nonsense. But I just swapped it to another computer. It worked fine. And surprisingly, it's not that difficult to find software that lets you channel USB-connected devices from one computer on a network to another computer on that same network.
Yeah, you're a bit noisy, so I wasn't really following well what you were trying to do. One of your computers, a noisy power supply, so you decided to run a different computer that you had needed a linear power supply for. I was a little confused. I'm not sure whether it was a noise or I just wasn't paying enough attention.
Yeah, give me a minute. Let me see if I can switch back to the old Starlink, so I'll get a little bit more volume on my voice. Okay, let me give it another try. Okay, hopefully this works. Yeah, the problem was that I have this LP500. It's a digital watt meter. And the idea is you can use a USB connection, plug it into your computer, run a piece of software that mirrors the display so that on my control surface in front of me, I see the watt meter as opposed to having to crane my neck towards the left. The only problem is that it would lock up the computer and cause all kinds of weird effects. I found out that I have a small ThinkPad on the side. I plugged the ThinkPad's USB port into this control, and it works fine on the ThinkPad, but I could also relay the serial device from one computer to another and still have it on the primary computer without any kind of locking up problems.
Oh, okay. I think I understand what you were trying to do there. Now, don't you get your power out from your Flex radio? Or is this power out after the antenna or something that's not shown on the Flex radio? Or from a different radio?
Theoretically, yeah, but that doesn't give me the... I put it through my linear amplifier, and I guess theoretically I could get the power output, but I wouldn't get the SWRs and all the other nice little features. So it's just the transmission line has a coupler, and it taps the coupler and translates the information into a peak and average power
and the audio envelope and the SWR and all kinds of other nice stuff.
Oh, I see. So you're getting a lot more information than you would from the power output display or power output data sent back to your computer from your linear RAM. Yeah, I forgot you're not running the flex radio barefoot.
Yeah, this watt meter also is capable of trapezoid. I can see how linear the meter is. So it's a nice visual watt meter. It's one of the prettiest ones available. I think there's only two at this point. What was it? Kit, the Reborn, the Zombie Heath kit was supposed to release some kind of vaguely digital watt meter, which looked awful. The mock-up was the ugliest device I ever saw, but I doubt that it ever went to production.
I still have a heat kick here that my dad built back in 1974, and it only stopped working 2 years ago. I think it still sort of works, actually. And I had an odd problem. It would lock up 20 meters, and I always assumed that was all up from my antenna. But when I tried it on field day, it did the same thing in a completely different station. So apparently it was some flaw in the old HD10, I think it was, that he could hear. And when you mentioned the antenna, mobile antenna, that acts like a dummy load, I remembered my old HeathKit antenna, which was actually a dummy load that my dad and I used tune up our station back in the 70s. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with a dummy load. I have dummy loads, and I use them when it's appropriate. And I think I've told this story. There was a time I was on the 10-meter net, and a guy who was maybe a mile away from me with a booming signal, his signal was about 20 dB over 9. And just as a kind of joke, both switched off of our antennas and onto our dummy loads, and we continued the conversation. Our dummy loads leaked enough power that we were both still able to talk to each other.
Yeah. I was thinking about that a little. I see these advertisements on YouTube. Somebody's selling a gadget that presumably lets you watch cable TV without paying for cable TV. And I think what it's doing is picking up or detecting and decoding the cable TV leakage. I think I had read that somewhere a couple of years ago. Go ahead.
Yeah, that sounds a little bit too sophisticated for most of these advertisements. Usually they're just outright fraud.
I'm always kind of amazed at the ridiculous ads on YouTube. I always tap them out after 10 seconds anyway. YouTube usually lets you do that. But most of them start out with, the U.S. government is trying to prevent you from buying this product. Usually that's all I listen to. But yeah, I get a kick out of somebody trying to sell an actual antenna that's called a cantenna, because that what would these kids call their dummy lobe back in the day.
Well, I see 2GS, by the way. I don't know if you keep up with frauds. About a year ago, a couple of people, I think, had this brilliant idea. They took some cheap Chinese deodorizing gadget and somehow suggested that, I forget exactly what it was supposed to do, whether it was supposed to dehumidify the car or whether it was a refrigerating device, some ridiculous thing that it was never meant to do. It's meant to kind of vaguely spread an odor around. And they must have sold thousands of those. The ads were all over the place.
I have a few questions about LC500.
Say again, Wesley. Your signal isn't that great on my reception tonight, so repeat.
Yeah, I have a question about LP500 and LP700.
Okay, what about it? The only difference between the 500 and the 700 is the display size. The 600 was an afterthought of the designer, and he said, gee, guys, what if I put it in a bigger box with a bigger screen? And unfortunately, since he didn't redesign the PCB, the buttons are off to the side because the PCB was sort of built for the LP500. But sure, what's your question, Wes?
Supposedly I had a P500 and then I have LPC501, which is HF and 6 meters coupler. Then I want 2 meters, so I have to buy another coupler. How do I connect that to 500?
Okay, that's a relatively simple one. In the back of the LP500 and 700 is 4 RG, RG45s. Each of those RJ45s can go to a different coupler, and then you can switch between them. So it's just a matter of getting, you hook up that coupler to the second open RJ45 receptacle, and you press F2 instead of F1, and that sends you to the next one. Or you can set it to automate the process. It has a feature that if there's a signal coming into one of the ports, it will reset itself to read out that port that's outputting power.
So I can have few couplers, and how many couplers can I connect?
You can connect 4 couplers.
Okay. Is there a coupler that covers H, F, and 2 meters, or there are two different couplers?
There are two different couplers. He had to modify the design for the coupler to work for 2 meters. It won't even work for 70 centimeters. If you have 70 centimeters, you have to wait for him to get around to reconfiguring the coupler device to operate on that. So it's one for HF, one for VHF, and eventually, maybe if we're all lucky, one for UHF.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Wesley. Once again, I'm AC2GS. This is the Limewire Technical Net. Still got a little spare time out there, so if anyone has any questions or comments or topics for discussion, get that to talk.
Quantum fluctuation, you want to talk about it?
Okay,
so before we go to that, Khan Academy, that's quite nice source for information, but there are a few guys there, I'm looking at it right now, fighting for speed of light. So before we go to quantum fluctuation, some of them say speed of light is constant, independent from the medium, and they rather say that this is an illusion of the light flowing out medium. Some others says that photon travels at the speed of light, but could be slowed down based on the medium, and then when it comes out from the medium, it gains the speed of light. Which one is true?
Okay. If it was true that light slows down in a different medium and then speeds up, you unfortunately have a violation of conservation of energy, which is it loses energy put into the material, the medium, that slows it down, but then to have it speed means you're putting energy in it. So you're violating conservation of energy. It goes, unfortunately, back to the confusion concepts of group velocity versus phase velocity. It seems as though the velocity of light is slowing down in a medium, but the actual real velocity of electromagnetic waves is set cubic feet of light in a vacuum. So there's a difference between the apparent velocity and the actual ultimate real velocity. So you can't violate the laws of conservation of energy. So the true velocity of light remains the same. The visualize the apparent velocity in a medium that slows it down is not an accurate assessment of what's going on.
So, quantum fluctuation. Maybe another thing. So, a photon cannot interact with another photon because it doesn't have a charge. So, charge in motion is electromagnetic wave. And now it possesses electric and magnetic field. And there is another discussion where some of guys in science try to promote the idea that although photon cannot interact with another photon, the electromagnetic wave can interact with electromagnetic wave. Back to you.
Well, you're kind of playing with words. Electromagnetic waves are photons. Photons are electromagnetic waves. Whether they're a particle or whether they're a wave phenomena, and the problem is that they're kind of neither, but can be discussed in certain aspects as both. So electromagnetic waves cannot interact directly with another electromagnetic wave without something working as a intermediary for these actions. In other words, if you need an antenna to kind of interact with two electromagnetic waves going at the antenna. If you don't have any antenna, the electromagnetic waves will not interact in any way. They won't interfere with each other, and they'll just go off in their own direction forever and ever and ever. So you still need some intermediary to act to have electromagnetic waves act with each other. They can't do them by themselves. And it's not exactly because they're charged, although that's part of it, but things interact with other things for a whole bunch of different reasons. Different particles can interact through different forces. Most of them interact through gravitational fields. Some of them interact through electromagnetic fields, and so it goes. So one of the things is an electromagnetic field, which photons are the electromagnetic field, so they can't have their own inherent charge. If you start to give a gravitational force, you end up with an endless, meaningless loop of things. You can't have a charge carrier also have a charge.
So I'm trying to bring some things that are usually not being asked for. That's why I'm not really trying to discuss, but rather bring it to the table. Okay, so absolute nothing less exists. Back to you.
You might rephrase that.
Can absolute nothing exist?
Okay. Whoever you are out there, take a nap. Can there be nothingness? It sort of is problematic in what do you quite mean by nothingness. Space-time is not nothing. If you're outside of space-time, I'm not quite sure what exactly that means. That would be kind of beyond the universe, in which time itself didn't exist. Time didn't exist. What does that mean? I'll leave that to philosophers. So the empty vacuum of space itself is full of space-time and full of quantum fields. The quantum fields can be at their lowest level, but they're still theoretically still there. And they're the means by which photons travel through space-time, they excite the electromagnetic quantum field. There are gravitational fields. There are a lot of other quantum fields that exist in the void of empty space. So outside, as long as you're talking about the universe, there is no place that is truly, completely devoid of anything.
The other guy's trying to cut. Yeah, I'm waiting till my antenna is going to start hitting the repeater. That's another second. So, seemingly empty space is filled with fluctuation of light and matter fields, leading to continuous popping into existence and disappearance of photons, as well as massive particles. Can you relate to that sense?
Okay, well, what you're kind of touching upon is a concept called virtual particles, which can drive a lot of people very crazy. And it annoyed Dick. I remember way back he wanted to know what was force that caused magnets to attract and repel, and I mentioned virtual photons, and he was not very pleased with me, as well as he shouldn't have, because I kind of said it as partially a joke. Virtual particles there's no proof of such things as virtual particles. Virtual particles is a sleight of hand that physicists use to simplify equations that are impossible to solve. Since they were used, there have been other methods to simplify equations that did not require the inclusion of the concept of virtual particles. And some physicists believe that there's no real such thing as virtual particles. It is a simplification of another highly much more complicated concept, in that the quantum fields that exist in the vast space-time can reach a certain level where an actual particle pops into existence, but it can also exist below that level where no particle comes into existence, but there is an excitation locally that produces some physics that can be mimicked by the concept of having virtual photons and other virtual particles. So not every physicist will tell you that virtual particles is a real thing. It's the bottom line.
I hope you can hear me now. Okay, so the quote, the University of Rosenberg and the University of Paris, scientists have now made a large leap towards controlling strongly enhanced vacuum fluctuations much faster than typical time scroll of virtual photons. To this end, they created a specialized semiconductor structure in which electrons are extremely strongly coupled to the light fields of tiny antennas designed to so-called target spectral range. Now, the reason that I'm quoting it is because they say that 1 trillion of a second is needed for ringing of the collapsing quantum vacuum that will allow, that is much faster than, I have that. The researchers show that the switching occurs within just a tenth of the trillion of a second, more than 10 times faster than oscillation cycle of virtual photons. Can you say a few words about it?
Not particularly, because I don't know the paper, and I don't know what they're using as the explanation of a virtual photon. Once again, I can find you loads of physicists who don't believe that there actually are virtual photons. It's just an aspect of the fluctuation of the field intensity that's being misdescribed.
Okay, so actually in this article, they say that they implemented functionality to switch off the coupling extremely rapidly. They said, we are pleased as the first data showed that the switch off worked perfectly, but we were thrilled when enhanced experiment shows an intriguing expected oscillation of the light field during switching. PhD Dr. Joshua Moore-Henwink says analyzing this, the ringing of collapsing quantum vacuum by custom cut, the researchers show that the switching occurs within the tenth of a trillion of the seconds, more than 10 times faster than oscillation cycle or the virtual photon. Maybe as right now, you know?
Well, it sounds like you said what you said the last time, and I'm saying that, unfortunately, you know, they're using terms that there are physicists out there that would kind of disagree. You know, maybe they're just using the terminology to simplify things, and usually simplification leads to more confusion. But like I said before, virtual photons is a thing that some physicists don't believe truly exists. They're not virtual. They're not quite photons. They're partial excitations of electromagnetic field, of the quantum fields, which is different. And, you know, maybe these particular guys like to use abbreviation, or maybe they don't agree with those people who believe in the different types of theoretical solutions to problems that don't require use of virtual particles. I don't know. So they're using a term that's not accepted 100% among physicists, so I don't know what to make of that.
So I started from the middle of the article, was trying just to point at the certain problems. At the beginning of it says, modern physics is increasingly discovering how our universe is shaped by fluctuating fields, physical fields, which not only lead to tiny shifts of spectral lines of an atoms, but moreover may cause the evaporation of black holes and are ultimately responsible for the large-scale structure of our universe formed during the inflationary period following the Big Bang. Yet controlling those fluctuations on the lab scale, which the relevant temporal precision has remained extremely challenging to this day. So it's just the guys who are playing with popping out particles. Back to you.
Okay, I think it's a big stretch to start talking about black holes and the Big Bang and the entirety of the universe based on some interesting solid-state studies, but, you know, it's their time, I guess.
Yeah, so the first question formulated here is, how do you understand quantum fluctuation in space, Victor?
I don't think there's any particular difference between quantum fluctuations in space or anywhere else. I mean, one of the places that you find that term used a lot is in the Big Bang Theorem, which is that there was a point singularity and a quantum fluctuation occurred that destabilized it and caused it to massively inflate. And that's the original Big Bang believed to have formed this particular galaxy. And it spread out, increasing its volume. The energy, since it can't be created or destroyed, is then spread thinner and thinner and thinner. At a certain point, it was the average kinetic energy was low enough for electrons to stay stuck to a nucleus, and ionization kind of got neutralized, radiation was able to, the universe was transparent and every kind of spread out and interacted with each other and gravitational fields and electric fields and such and led to the forming of galaxies, et cetera, et cetera. But all supposedly with a quantum fluctuation, which is a kind of a fuzzy term, unfortunately. It would be nice if there was a better way of describing the quantum fluctuation. But most Most the starts of the Big Bang Theory start with the good old quantum fluctuations.
Okay. One of the students asked a question. Waves are simply differences in particular physical medium or field resulting in vibration and oscillation. If we have a perfect vacuum in space and we have a single photon, how does that photon change its loses its energy over the distance?
If there's nothing to interact with it, it doesn't lose. It doesn't attenuate. The inverse square law is not a attenuation interacting with space-time. It's a geometric concept. The total energy, as long as there's not anything that interacts with the photons and absorbs their energy, the total energy going outwards remains identically the same. The thing is, though, it spreads out geometrically as the inverse square law. So it doesn't absorb. A photon, as long as you don't have anything getting in its way, a photon will go on forever.
So far, like 100% of your answers. from classical physics, body put in motion, stay in motion. What is the difference, though, for that photon between classical physics and quantum?
In relation to what? The problem with classical physics is classical physics tends to really want a universal framework. A certain point to be a reference point, whereas the Einstein's theory kind of says that there is no inherent point reference point in space-time that's better than any other. So that's the major difference between classical physics and relativity.
That was my comment in regards to single thing in space and the body in space, so physical matter in space. So body in motion, stay in motion in space. The same is photon that cannot lose its energy, it goes forever. By that, I understand that inverse square law applies to the geometric pattern that is the difference between omnidirectional antenna and a straight point direction of the single photon. Back to you.
Okay. There is no geometry of a single photon. A single photon travels and there's no other reference photon that spreads out according to diffraction and other standard rules. So I'm not quite sure of the point.
Yeah, the point was that light sent from the distant galactics and the distant stars doesn't have to be seen as strength of that light at the time that was produced or that was leaving that star, the time that came after billions of years to the Earth, because it is the same. If it couldn't lose its energy and to exchange.
Individual photon doesn't lose, and if it doesn't interact with anything, it doesn't lose its energy. But the number of photons that are released on a sun certainly do decrease in reference to your destination because they veer off in other directions and don't arrive at your detector site. So a single object does not really attenuate unless it interacts with something. A coalesced beam of millions and billions of photons do spread out, and geometrically their energy when they reach a reference detector, decreases by the inverse squibble.
Some time ago, I sent you the material about this trench metal. Did you have a chance to go with it?
Very, very quickly. It's another one of those, gee, isn't that esoteric type of thing. I didn't know quite what to really make of it for usefulness at this time.
It was a cut that was previously quite interesting to MIT physicists, so it's a shaping state of matter. In other words, it's creating a properties that are not present normally in the nature, but rather making the unusual physics or physical properties that are comfortable to us in high temperature superconductors and a variety of other applications and textures.
Okay, so, let's do something use with it and come back and tell me about it. These are all kinds of very, very ephemeral type of comments to be made, has promise. A lot of people bottom of their regard with it. George has promise. Bill has promise. So, okay, I don't know what to do with that. I think they do either, personally.
I've seen that the article in the Wikipedia about this trench metal, but what I find out was that the idea came out 4 years ago for this trench metal, a state of matter found in quantum materials, including superconductors that have certain applications to us. I'm trying right now to find it. Wikipedia article, but unfortunately it sends me to thermoliquid theory. Anyhow, I think I rest. It says about the Soviet physicists. Okay, that becomes not interesting. Okay, I think I rest my case. Thank you very much. And to
actually. Okay, very good. It's always a nice change of pace to discuss relativity and quantum mechanics. Once again, this is AC2GS. This is the Limewalk Technical Net. So we still got a few more minutes. It's up to you guys. If you got a question or a comment or a topic for discussion, feel free to hit that push to talk. Okay, I guess I tired you out tonight. Well, I still hope a great Memorial Day. It's a little early, but, maybe we'll just finish up a little early tonight. I will give it one last try. Anyone with any questions or comments before we turn it over to Paul for the space report? Very well. Well, Paul, I hand the gang over to you. I wish you luck, and I'll be coming back when you're done.
Okay, fine business, Roy. AC2GS, WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And everybody had a good Memorial Day. I always put my flag out for Memorial Day, Flag Day, and what's the other one? Veterans Day. But, I have a few topics. There's nothing going on. Be a low this time of year. And we're waiting for eventually the Starliner to get off the ground. Talking about that week after week, month after month, and they have countless delays. And the latest delay pushes it to June 1st, not too long from now, but hopefully it'll go. I think it's 12:30, roughly 12:30 in the afternoon. So, it was supposed to go off last Saturday. Sunday. Actually, it was supposed to get last week, and then the week before that, and so on. Keeps getting delayed. they made it to the launch complex 41, ready to go. Beginning of May, was it May 4th? And the crew on board, Tony Williams, she's a ham, and going up with Butch Wilmore, and they got in the spacecraft, ready to go. And then they called it a couple of hours before it was going to launch due to a vibration that they heard. You could hear it outside the spacecraft. You could hear it. It was cycling back and forth. They said around 40 hertz per second. It was a lot of vibration. And it turns out to be a relief valve. It's similar to what you would have on a boiler. You know, you would have a spring-loaded a relief valve. Put a little pressure behind it and push the spring up. And, you know, water or steam will come flying out, relieving the pressure on your relief valve. You have to have that on every boiler, you know. Pressure starts to build up, and you have explosion, and your boiler becomes a rocket. They didn't know to go right through a roof, like a hot water tank. And somebody says, well, I don't need this relief valve. Let me just plug it up. And then, boom, when something goes wrong. Similar situation with the spacecraft, liner being built by Boeing, sitting on a Atlas V rocket, and the upper stage of that Atlas V rocket is liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen, and being a liquid oxygen system, that has to be very cold, it's a couple hundred degrees below zero. And if it starts to warm up a little bit, the pressure would start to build up, and you need to have a relief valve. And that's what this does. It would constantly vent any oxygen overboard. And then at the same time, if you lose an oxygen, it would start replenishing it from the launch complex. But, you know, to have this thing vibrating like that, you know, opening and closing really fast, they felt it. That's the reason to cancel everything they did. They put it back to the processing facility, after the scrub. And eventually they were able to change out that valve. So they feel like they're good to go now. But they've had that kind of problem before. It's not an unusual problem with that. It just hasn't happened in quite a while with that type of system. So it was no big deal. It just caused the scrub. But when they got it back to the processing facility, they also noticed a slight helium leak in the Starliner service module. You have the Starliner, and that's the part that actually completely comes back. And then part of that system is the service module that provides power and propulsion, you know, for the spacecraft. Turns out there was a slight helium leak in near one of the they call them dog houses. Different locations around the spacecraft have reaction control systems, RCS, and they need to use them. You know, the fuel goes into that hypergolic fuel. So, you know, the second that starts flowing, it would ignite, and that's how the reaction control systems work. But they don't have pumps behind it. They have helium. Helium pushes on this stuff, and that's what pushes the fuel into the reaction control system. Well, apparently that one of the manifolds must have a slight leak, but very slight, where it's not even notable. They are deciding not to fix that. Flow is so little, so minimal, that you could multiply that times 100 times and still wouldn't affect the mission. So to completely disassemble that, to get onto that, that would require not days, but weeks, or maybe even a month. They'd rather not do that. So on June 1st, hopefully Starliner gets off the launch pad. So we'll see. The one topic I really wanted to go over was an update on the Gateway space station that will eventually be going around the moon. Gateway is scheduled to be launched in pieces within a couple of years, become an orbiting laboratory around the moon. So hopefully we get one of two new ham shacks we have, in space. Right now we have one on the International Space Station. And then we should eventually have two more. One eventually on the moon. Hopefully they eventually have a base there. And you could have another ham shack in orbit. An orbit is actually being planned by the ARRL and AMSAT. But that's the ham-related part of the story. The main part of the story is how you're going to get the Gateway system, which really consists of three main pieces. They're going to be attached to one another. And each one weighs, over 20,000 pounds. So how do you get 60,000 pounds to the moon? Living quarters, and all the things you're going to need to keep a crew of four on board for minimum time of 1 month. Gateway is designed to be permanently manned. It will be maintained robotically from mission control. They'll have a robotic arm on it, built by Canada, and software and everything will be controlled by mission control. But, for a time period of at least a month or so, you'll have a crew on board, a crew of four. The idea of the Gateway is to have access to spacecraft that are going to moon. Plan on docking with Gateway, and then you could have another crew of four spend some time on the space station before they get ready and prepare themselves to undock in another spacecraft that will be pre-positioned and also attached to that space station. It'll be one of two space vehicles, either one by SpaceX that will be a Starship that will be able to land on the moon and turn safely to Gateway. Or you could have the spacecraft that's being built by Blue Origin, which is the other contract that NASA let out. Same idea, attached to the space station, be able to go down to the moon a couple of days, a week, whatever it is, and then return to the moon. And that's the initial plan. Do that, you need to get a station into orbit. And the first three modules are being built now in Italy. It's a company that built these things. They built a bunch of modules for the International Space Station. They also built Cygnus, which is a cargo spacecraft that's sent up by Northrop Grumman. Every now and then to resupply the International Space Station. So they're good at building these modules. So NASA has been building a couple. And then the European Space Agency also has contracts with this company to do that as well for another module. So the initial three modules you need is that actually need power and propulsion. So they call it the PPE. Module, which is the power and propulsion, which will consist of solar panels and engines and thrusters to keep the space oriented properly and to allow it to be in orbit around the moon. And that will be attached to the HALO module. The HALO module is called the Habitation and Logistics Outpost, or HALO. And that's the actual living quarters that astronauts will live in, one of the livable modules. Those two will be attached, and that's the initial ones. And then another one by the European Space Agency will eventually be sent out, and that one's a little bit bigger. That's called the IHAB. By the way, European Space Agency and Japan have a part of that. So this is an international project, this whole gateway system. So the idea is to eventually put these things into orbit, a couple of years. And they're going to start with the PPE, the power propulsion.